This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So, I don't know about you, but I get the impression Pep Guardiola and the Manchester City players who were at the club last season took last year's defeat to Real Madrid personally.
I had the feeling that all the pain that we had during one season, 1 year, what happened last season, was today there.
So how do you make sure that Real Madrid can't do Real Madrid things in the Champions League? You make Manchester City do Manchester City things instead. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon podcast, in a week where things have probably never been better. What many feared would be a tough test at Goodison Park was passed with flying colours, helped further by results elsewhere, and then what's probably the club's best ever performance saw them through to their second Champions League final in three seasons. With an FA Cup final place already booked, there's only so long the T-word can be ignored. With just one more win needed to secure a third successive Premier League title, we'll hear from The Athletic's Liam Toomey to fill us in on the issues at Chelsea. Spoiler alert, there's lots of them. And we'll also catch up with Brighton fan and podcaster Ryan Adsert to look ahead to the game in midweek. Plenty to discuss then, so let's get into it. I'm David Mooney, and with me for this one, I am joined by the editor of Football 365, Sarah Winterburn. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, David.
And City fan Sam Roscoe. Hello, Sam.
Hi, mate.
How are you doing? The last time you were on, it was after the exit from the League Cup at the hands of Southampton. You always seem to be on after crushing defeats. I remember you being on after the Lyon exit in the Champions League a few years ago. The last time you were on, you actually said this.
Every time I do the podcast, it's a cathartic event for me.
There we go. So I booked you in before the Madrid game. You must have been fearing the worst.
I did think that, to be honest with you. I thought, oh no, we know what this means. I'm going to be doing the podcast on Thursday after the biggest game of City's recent history. But it's what a lovely change. This is nice, isn't it?
Got to break the duck sometime, haven't you?
Well, thank God that it's this week. My voice is just about coming back after all the celebrating and screaming and shouting, and yeah, just fantastic. Really, really surreal, to be honest. It's not really sunk in. I was incredibly nervous before the game. I bumped into our good friend Richard Burns and his dad before outside the stadium, and they did help to settle some of the nausea that had set in. But yeah, it just sensational, wasn't it? And again, it's just not set in how close things are now to this being
the T-word.
The T-word, and it's really cliche, but it's one of those sort of out-of-body experiences at the minute that I'm having, where you think, when I need to like really fully appreciate every single second at the moment, because if it goes the way that we all want it to go, in years to come, these moments will be remembered forever.
Yeah, Sarah, I've always said, and I guess this kind of crosses football. It's not a specific City thing, and it kind of speaks into Sam's nerves and my nerves ahead of the game on Wednesday night. I've always said I like winning things. The winning of them can be a bit difficult sometimes.
Yeah, I think, as a Huddersfield Town fan, I don't quite have the same feelings that you guys do approaching such a big games. But, I mean, I must say, yesterday people kept saying to me, do you think they'll do it? And you kind of your logical brain is going, well, yes, of course, they're the best team in Europe. I mean, why wouldn't they? And the other bit of your brain's going, Real Madrid, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that kind of sums it up. And even at 2-0, you kind of, because of what happened last year, you're thinking, this, you know, if they score, then it's with them, isn't it? It's momentum and all those, you know, everything like that comes into your brain. But it just turns out that Man City are the best team in Europe, and they just absolutely strolled through it.
I saw a tweet at 2-0 that said, Madrid have got City exactly where they want them. And that just kind of sums up the attitude that Madrid have in that competition. They do weird things. I don't understand how it happens. Sarah, in all honesty, though, looking as a neutral into that game, I, as a City fan, am struggling to think of a better 90-minute performance from City than that. What was it like to watch as kind of someone with no investment in the game?
Not quite no investment. I've got a stepdaughter who's absolutely mental City fan, so she was screaming. At one point, my wife ran in thinking she'd you know, died basically. but yeah, from a sort of half outsider's point of view, I absolutely agree with you. I think if you take into account the opposition, we've all seen City tear teams apart before, and you know that usually comes with caveats, doesn't it? But this was a Real Madrid side who, however people want to paint it, that this is not the greatest Real Madrid side ever, it's at the end of an era, etc., etc. If you look at the quality of that opposition and that lineup, to have done that to that team was extraordinary to watch. It wasn't even that Real Madrid didn't lay a glove on them. They didn't even put their gloves on. It was over before it began. The first 10 minutes, you kind of thought, oh, wow, this, if they keep this up. And Real Madrid did not know what to do with it. And towards the end, just, you know, Carlo Ancelotti, never known as the most tactical manager anyway, was just resorting to sort of, you know, your Sunday football tactics of throw on everybody that you can think of. It doesn't matter about the formation, doesn't matter about the plan, doesn't matter about patterns, just whang them all on and hope something happens. And it never did. And that's exactly as it should have been, because they absolutely didn't deserve anything from that. And City deserved everything, because that was a complete performance.
Yeah. Sam, what do you think made it come together so well in this one moment? Because we're talking, I mean, it's not long ago we were talking about City's struggles in the Champions League and, you know, these big nights they find problematic. If you were to tell me that one of those teams had 14 Champions Leagues or European Cups and had all the experience, it would have been City if you didn't know it was Real Madrid, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think one thing for me that's really... I'll be totally honest, at the about 2 months ago, I did not see City putting 11 Premier League wins together. I didn't see that level of performance that we witnessed against Real Madrid anywhere near, really. It was very inconsistent. I think they hadn't put a run of four wins together in the Premier League for a long time, let alone this unbelievable stretch that they've been on at the minute, which is why they're in the position that they are now. I think the biggest thing for me is 60 minutes before kickoff, when that team sheet is announced, you know exactly what it's going to be, because I think we know now what City's best 11 is at the moment, and they're playing out the skin, aren't they? The system works. John Stones has been fantastic. Kyle Walker's come back in the past sort of 6 weeks and has been absolutely fantastic, despite the sort of public criticism that Guardiola put on him. It's fantastic man management, you could argue, to sort of put it on him like that, and he's responded really well. Ilkay Gundogan is just playing off Erling Haaland so well. Like, Haaland is occupying a lot of defenders and they've got a lot to think about, and that's just giving Gundogan so much free room. Likewise with De Bruyne. I think what really impressed me against Real Madrid was how Manchester City exploited Real Madrid's left-hand side. Camavinga was excellent in that makeshift left-back role in the first leg. However, he was massively exposed when he drifted into the centre. Vinicius, for the incredible talent that he is, wasn't getting back as often and was getting caught out. There's a lot of space down their left-hand side, and City exploited that really well. And there was often a lot of two-on-ones against the likes of Modric and, you know, Camavinga would have to work back in, etc. I think that was the interesting tactical switch from Ancelotti in the second half, which probably didn't come early enough for them when he moved Alaba out to the left, bringing Rudiger on and Camavinga off. But yeah, Bernardo Silva was absolutely fantastic down that side with Kevin De Bruyne and John Stones and Rodri really anchoring it. I love they did this a lot in the first tie as well, but I love how Stones and Rodri just read each other's minds so well on the football field. When one goes, one stays. And that was where City were getting a lot of joy. The runs from Stones or Rodri when they were driving through the centre towards, you know, the on Real Madrid's goal. It was creating a lot of space for the likes of Silva, Grealish, Gundogan, De Bruyne, etc. And that's where they really punished them.
Yeah, I still get a bit nervous though when I'm even though I know he's good on the ball and I know it's the job for him to do, I still get a bit nervous when I see it's John Stones still carrying the ball as the 18-yard line's appearing. It's just like he's playing centre half, lads. Can we just make sure it's a bit more normal sometimes? let's hear this from Guardiola, because I'm wondering if there's kind of an unquantifiable aspect of this. We talked in the intro about what happened last season and the kind of feeling from that as well. Guardiola said this in the post-match press conference.
They play with a desire. We spoke just before to go to the pitch. We spoke and said, do you want to play against Inter or not? Do you want to play against Inter? Yeah or no? As yourself. If you play 90 minutes thinking, I want to play against Inter, you will beat Real Madrid. In the bad moments, if you want to play against Inter de Milan, you are going to win the game. And they play in that spirit that we need to do it.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Now, Sarah, I'm far from me to suggest that one team being hungrier than the other is bullshit, because it feels like bullshit. But could that just be the unquantifiable thing? City was so scarred by last season. It was like, just don't let that happen again.
I actually am going to dismiss that. I think this was just a case of, I think Pep's, of course there's an element of a little bit of revenge and all that, but this was just a simply a phenomenal Man City side coached to perfection. And exactly what you were saying about, you know, this didn't feel like a faffy side, does it? It doesn't feel, you know, you weren't waiting for the lineup wondering who was going to be in it. You knew exactly who was going to be playing and you knew exactly what position they'd been playing. The last 2 months have been leading up to this moment. They've been honing this lineup. It's nice to think about passion and all those sort of unfathomables and unmeasurables. But
everybody's passionate, aren't they? That's the thing, yeah.
Exactly. And what we've been told many times about this Real Madrid side is how special a Champions League is to them. There's no way anybody goes into a Champions League game with more desire than Real Madrid, because it defines them, doesn't it? Absolutely defines them. I think, you know, this was, like you said, everything about it, everything that Sam said about the way that team is working at the moment, you know, you can remark on, you know, Jack Grealish's defensive work, which, fine, you know, it's like it's taken a while, but it's like 18 months in, he's at the absolutely complete City player. You know, John Stones using his, the stuff about Kyle Walker is really interesting, because I think what Pep's done there is just spoken about him as he would speak about any other player. You might say, oh, you know, Kevin De Bruyne has got the touch, but he hasn't got the pace. So-and-so's got the, you know.
He did it with De Bruyne as well, didn't he, earlier in the season? Yeah. That's when De Bruyne had a bit of a dip in form. You know, I think he came out and said something around him then, didn't he? Yeah. So he does have that track record. Mm. And like I said, it is that man management from him that he knows gets a response.
And they absolutely trust him as well. And I don't think Kyle Walker will have had his back put out by that. I think he's just thought, no, come on, you know. I might not be the cleverest, but, you know, look how quick I am. You know, when you see him absolutely killing Vinicius, you know, Vinicius for pace, he's 32 or whatever. This doesn't make any sense, really. And I think Pep wasn't saying, oh, you know, Kyle Walker's not the player. He's basically saying, you know, in the same way we talked about Calvin Phillips and his weight, these are the reasons these players are not in my team at the moment. And then, you know, deal with it. I'm not even sure it's man management or just him being sort of searingly honest about what he expects and about that perfect level that he expects. I suppose the worrying thing now, and you tell me how it feels as City fans, is if you fail now, it's far more painful and more embarrassing than if you failed against Real Madrid.
Oh God,
and
yeah.
I know from what I'm hearing, you know, what emails we're getting and everything, every, you know, neutrals are Team Inter now. And they're looking for that embarrassing fall in the final. You know, in some ways, it would have been a lot easier to lose to Real Madrid, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. But, I mean, City find new and bold ways to break your heart every year. So it's with all the success comes the knowledge that somewhere along the lines, City will find a way that only City can break you. So so I look forward to seeing how it happens. Edin Dzeko, anyone in the final? There we go. Sam, Sarah mentioned Real Madrid's kind of aura in the Champions League and what they do. This is a hell of a loaded question for you to answer, and I'm sorry about this, but are City getting an aura in the Champions League?
I don't know if they're getting an aura in the Champions League, but I think they're getting an aura in general. I've noticed that this season, and I think there's a number of reasons why, but the biggest factor for me is the Erling Haaland factor. Like, people come to watch Erling Haaland now at City.
Didn't score, though, did he?
To watch Man City. well, he tried, didn't he? I don't know what more he could have done, to be honest with you. Three fantastic saves from Courtois. I think the third one, the one-on-one, I think when I watched it back, he just sort of catches it with his heel. It looks as though he's sort of struggling to get it out of his feet a little bit. But regardless, you know, three great saves. And again, the Haaland thing, obviously, you know, he just scores goals, blah, blah, blah. He does more than that, though, because he occupies defenders really well and he gives defenders some big questions to answer. And that really helps the likes of De Bruyne, Gundogan, Grealish, Bernardo, Mahrez, Foden, etc., play in those pockets of space that's created when defenders are sucked into marking Haaland and focusing on him. So that's one impact this season. Haaland is giving City that aura. And, you know, that's the game against Real Madrid was the 15th straight win in the competition at the Etihad Stadium. So they're becoming a bit of a force in Europe now as well.
Oh, who were the last team to win there then? Lyon? Must have been Lyon then in 2018 or so.
That's a question that I don't quite know the answer to.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to stump you with that.
On the next Blue Moon podcast quiz, maybe.
Yeah, I'll keep that one in the back pocket for a bit later. Sarah, let's touch on some of the individual performances because Sam's reeling off the names time and again on this show so far. The one I want to start with, though, is Rodri. His performance, watching him in the stadium, was incredible because he was always there, available for a pass, ready to break up the pressure. Ready to take the ball whenever somebody was desperate to get rid of it in the City defensive third. But at the same time, he was always there on the edge of the Madrid box to just be that kind of wall pass for somebody else to bounce it off to get them in behind. It was an incredible performance.
It was, but we're past the point now where we're remotely surprised by, are we? I think he's far beyond anybody in that position, certainly in the Premier League and amongst the top five in the world, I would say at the moment. You know, people have this idea of him, don't they, that he does the simple things and all that. It's not that simple to play like that. It really isn't. And, you know, I've played a lot in defensive midfield and it's exhausting, not physically exhausting, but because you are constantly looking to put out fires and then also getting the ball and doing something with it. And he is astonishing at it. And everything Sam said there about John Stones as well, it's like John Stones has been watching Rodri as he has been from behind him, you know, for the last two or three years and worked out how you do this, how, you know, John Stones is clearly a much more intelligent player than we've ever sort of given him credit for. We always knew he was a sort of cultured player, et cetera, but he clearly, you know, he's played right back incredibly well. And now he's playing in that hybrid role between midfield and defence really well. But Rodri, for me, is in a class of his own. He's one of those, again, we always talk about these undervalued players, don't we? And I think we're getting to the point where these players aren't undervalued anymore. But Rodri, for me, last night, again, you know, you saw in that first leg, didn't you, that you know, Modric and Kroos, for however good they are, just thought, do you know what, we'll just step off here because there's no point. There's no point trying to compete with this, you know, and allowing them to sort of have the ball. But for me, Rodri steps into any World 11 in that position every day of the week.
Yeah. Not talked about De Bruyne properly yet, Sam. There was a moment in the second half where he was literally doubled over with exhaustion. He'd worked that hard. It was no surprise. I mean, it was the only surprise was that he didn't come off earlier because he only came off on about 85 minutes or so. But he left everything on that pitch, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And that's what we've come to expect from Kevin De Bruyne, isn't it? You know, he puts everything into these huge games. He's a match winner for Manchester City. He is a key player. And he really gets them over the line. Obviously, was absolutely fantastic in Madrid in the first leg. Brilliant goal that that levelled the first leg, and then last night, you know, just assist after assist after assist. Really, really key player for City, and yeah, he leaves everything out there, don't you? And that's what you love to see as well. You know, you absolutely love it when a player is putting every effort in where he can, and I do agree he did look like he'd done that. It's funny, isn't it? Like every game, his shirt is always just absolutely wringing, like wet with sweat.
Yeah, when his cheeks go bright red that you know, right? He's done it.
It's like his shirt goes navy, doesn't it? I always think poor kids who have to get Kevin De Bruyne's shirt because it must stink.
You know? Yeah,
he's not got the colouring to make that kind of effort, has he? Because he immediately goes bright red. Like, you know, bright red, sweaty, very, you know, it's he can't do it smoothly, can he? He always looks absolutely shattered when he's shattered. Yeah. And he did look broken in that second half, actually.
Yeah, you'd have to, I mean, if your kid got his shirt after the game, you'd have to wash that, wouldn't you? You'd have to put it in the washing machine. It'd be that.
Yeah, I tell you what, you'd stick it in the boot of the car on the way home, wouldn't you? You wouldn't have it in the back.
Yeah. You'll be putting it on anyway.
Yeah.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's talk Bernardo, Sarah, because he scored twice. They were the headlines, but they were by far and away not the highlights of his game, just the work rate and the effort he was putting around the pitch to be everywhere again. Like Sam said, kept finding those pockets of space, and who knew he could score with his head? It's about the 10th time he's done it now in his City career. He keeps scoring headers as someone who's like 4'6".
It's amazing, isn't it? It always feels kind of counterintuitive when you see a smaller guy scoring a header. But, you know, we should be used to it by now, shouldn't we? We've seen, you know, even Sterling used to score a few with his head as well, isn't it? If you're in the right place at the right time, it doesn't matter how many inches you're giving away, so to speak. we said before, didn't we, how much space, you know, and the Haaland factor is massive here, isn't it? Because like you say, it isn't generally always the case that he will always score goals. He won't even, may not even have a meaningful touch. But if you're a centre-half, you have to, you know, not only one of you, probably two of you are occupied by him all the time. And if you're not occupied by him, you're looking where he is, which leaves space for those clever players like Bernardo Silva, like Gundogan. But we saw it again. You know, it makes me laugh when you see headlines about Bernardo Silva desperately wanting to leave Man City. And then you see performances like that and you think, well, if he's hiding it incredibly well, isn't he? Because, you know, he may well want to leave at some point, but my God, he gives everything while he's there. And I love the way that he seamlessly, like we talked again about moving into that right-hand side, and they really did. You know, at times you thought him, De Bruyne, Stones, Walker all seemed to be occupying quite, you know, that space towards the right-hand side of the midfield when Real Madrid had no idea what to do with it because they're constantly moving, constantly doing, you know. And then on the other side, you've got Grealish who kind of sticks wide a little bit. So you're creating that space in the middle again, aren't you? But yeah, Bernardo Silva and the finishing, again, phenomenal. I mean, I don't quite know. It's very difficult game to analyse, isn't it? Because we're basically saying they're all absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's hard when everyone drops a 10 out of 10, isn't it? It's like it's one of those like ridiculous things. Yeah. He was good as well. Final player to focus on, Sam, is Manuel Akanji. I don't know if you heard his interviews afterwards, but he was absolutely adamant that goal, the third one, was his. I'm willing for him to have it. It took a massive deflection, whether or not he touched it. You know, he claims he did. That's good enough for me. But ultimately, like, that's not the highlight. The highlight is that he's a centre-half, the fifth-choice centre-half at the start of the season, playing at left-back in a tie like this and not looking out of position. How does that work?
I've been really impressed with Akanji in these past couple of months. I think there was a period where I felt at times he was getting into liability territory, but he's done really well. He's adapted really well. He looks really comfortable as well in whatever system he's asked to play, whether it is out on the left or in the centre. He just looks really calm as well. That's the other thing. He's doing the simple things absolutely spot on, which is key for a team like Manchester City, the way they play. So, yeah, he's been brilliant, and he's really stepped up. And it's great because obviously Ake was a big plus down that left-hand side for the likes of Jack Grealish. I think Ake's really enabled Jack Grealish to come into his own this season. And obviously with him being out, why is it we have such an issue with that left-hand side? You know, like Ake obviously being out, but Akanji steps up, comes in, absolutely no trouble. So
it's like,
yeah, really impressive.
It's like that evolution of man sort of image, isn't it? Where you go back from Neanderthal to human and you kind of work through all of City's left backs and you've got like a left back, then you've got a left-footed midfielder, and then you've got a left-footed winger who kind of comes in there, and then it's a right-footed right back, and then a left-footed centre-half, and then you finish with a right-footed centre-half, and you just kind of build in as you go through all the different stages. Sarah, we touched on the T word a bit earlier on. I want to talk about it a little bit more now. I'm going to ask you about it because then I'm not making Sam, as a City fan, jinx anything. Guardiola was asked if he was comfortable talking about the treble after the game. This is what he said.
Let me win the first two. Let me win listen, at the end we have the Premier League, we are close. You know, we need one more game. And I would say when you play against our neighbours and the final Champions against Italian team, it's big calm. So the season is really, really good. It's really done already. So now we hope we have to lift it. But the pleasure, the joy, like how much we have fun this season again and again with our people. We make happy our fans, you know, all around the world watching us. They saw a good team playing. This is the biggest compliment. Come on. It's not going to change now. But we are close, and of course we're going to try.
Obviously, you don't want to talk about the treble, but at what point do you have to tell the players that in their careers you might never get a better chance to make
history? That's why they know
at
it.
At what point do you start reminding the players of that they are that close to it?
No, of course we are there. So now the players can think about it, can visualize it, so it's normal. So all the people talk each other, we're going to win it everything, we're going to win everything. So they had that feeling that it's normal. We are three games away, one each of the competition, we can do it. But for me, it's more important after many years, 3 years in a row, so especially after first back-to-back doing that, you know, we are there. That is, because they had a lot of work. People say how good they are, the squad, and yeah, that's right. But they had a lot of work behind the scenes to achieve what we are achieving.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Is that the key point there, Sarah, that people forget the work that goes in from Guardiola and everybody else? Just because, I mean, you can't deny it. City have spent a lot of money. The squad is worth a lot of money. They've spent an absolute ton assembling this team of superstars. But you can't just put them together and it all work fine. And you can't just put them together and get the result that City have. So do people forget what Guardiola's input in this is?
I don't think forget's the right word. I think willfully ignore. You know, there's, you know, we've had a lot of mails after last night, basically saying, oh, it means nothing. It means nothing because of the money, et cetera, et cetera. It means nothing because of the charges. And you can't argue with people who have that stance. They're not going to change their minds on it. So those people aren't forgetting or not seeing what Pep Guardiola does. They're willfully ignoring it. I think, but anybody who knows anything about football and knows how other teams have attempted to do this over the years with lots and lots of money and have not got anywhere near the kind of perfection that we're seeing from City at the moment, I think, you know, it kind of doesn't matter, does it? But it's really interesting what Guardiola was saying there, because he's trying to sort of downplay it and say, we've already achieved. But unfortunately, once you get into this position where you are odds on to win three things, you're odds on to win the whole thing, you're now getting to the point where failing on any of those fronts is seen as exactly that, as a failure, you know, but from the outside world. And that creates this a massive pressure. So I think the only way City don't do this is if that just becomes too big. If that, you know, everyone's desperate to talk about the treble. Everyone, you know, that they were pushing him about talking about the treble, because obviously he's not wanted to speak back before, but now it's become too close, too big, too, you know, it's right there, isn't it? So it's impossible to ignore. But that's the biggest problem that City have got in the next few weeks, is the weight of that. You know, that feeling that actually, as much as they might think, oh, we've won three in a row. Of course, that is a massive thing to win three in a row. Only four teams have done it before, and you'll know who these are, David. Liverpool, Man United, Arsenal and Huddersfield Town. If you want to be as good as Huddersfield Town, you've got to work for this.
Yeah, I did wonder when that might come up.
Yeah, so, you know, you've got to, but I can see why he sees that as an achievement, and like something that's very, very rare. It's really difficult to do it three times in a row, clearly. But unfortunately, the rest of the world is looking on and saying, right, if you fail on any of those fronts, that's the season's a failure. That's the problem. It's, you know, it's the same thing that Arsenal have had all season. You know, it's all right arguing that that's not where you expected to be. But once you are within sight of it and then fail, then that's all anybody ever remembers, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think that's the biggest weight on City in the next few weeks. Not can they beat Man United? Of course they can beat Man United. They're a much better side than Man United. Can they beat Inter Milan? Of course they can beat Inter Milan. They're a much better side than Inter Milan. Of course they're going to win the Premier League. I think that's the one that they will tick off without any problems whatsoever. They'll tick that off that week, mm-hmm. this weekend, no problem. But the Man United games and the Inter Milan games are not about those games, are they? We can talk all day about tactics. We can talk all day about matchups and how teams will counter them, etc., etc. It doesn't matter. It's all about what's in City's heads now, is to whether they are capable of ignoring all the outside noise and just focusing on those games as games. And that's it. 90-minute games, bish, bash, bosh, get them done. But unfortunately, you know, the T word, as you put it, is going to be what is sort of hanging over them in the next few weeks.
You know what, though? I actually think it because they're now in a position where it is just three games. Like they just have to win three games. It's so simple. It's the simplest point it can be at, and it literally is. Like, it's
too
so
simple.
Cliche.
Too simple, if you ask me.
It's cliche, but it literally is game by game now. Like, you know, they beat Chelsea. That's the Premier League done. Then okay, there's Brighton and Brentford. Chance to freshen up a little bit, maybe get some energy back. Then it's Manchester United. Go into that game. They've got to win that game. Don't even think about the Champions League final, because it's game by game. And then it's on to Inter. It's very surreal. It's very surreal saying it's never been simpler now to win the treble.
Simply go and win
just
a treble.
Three games.
Yeah.
Go and win three games of football, and your names will be etched into forever glory.
Yeah. Well, let's turn our attention to the Premier League then. It was a 3-0 win over Everton on Sunday, followed by Arsenal's 3-0 defeat at home to Brighton. We've got the games against Chelsea and Brighton to preview shortly. But first, Sam, going into Goodison, is it weird to say that the situation in the league as it was, I was more nervous about that game at Goodison Park than I was about the Madrid game last night?
Well, again, it goes back to this thing of cliche game by game. You know, it's you sort of zone out of everything else that's coming up, and this is the most important thing right now. You know, you have to prioritise, don't you? And that's exactly what Pep Guardiola has been doing and Manchester City have been doing. And as fans, I think we've all subconsciously felt that way as well. That look, you know, the most important thing is the next 90 minutes and getting 3 points from Goodison. Although the recent record there has been very good, I think there's still a lot of pessimism around going to Goodison Park. And for 30 minutes, I was a bag of nerves. But they got through it. And in the end, you know, they made it look pretty easy. They brushed them aside. There weren't any major issues. They didn't have any injuries, which was the other good thing to take from that. I think when they got into that cruising mode in the second half, I think it was definitely like, right, game management, now we can start to think about Real Madrid. Yeah. And I actually think the week before, the Leeds game put them in really good stead for this final run, because get the games done, then we can start to you know, think about the next sort of lot of fixtures coming up. But they didn't play the occasion. You know, they didn't play they didn't play the way I was feeling before going into the game at Goodison Park, which was pretty nervous, confident, but like, you know, it's still that pessimistic City side, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. So I think the biggest compliment is how professional City have been in their performances. Maybe there's a potential question mark on the Leeds performance when it comes to that last little bit. But we, you know, the guys spoke about that quite a lot at length on the previous podcast, and we've moved on since then. So
yeah, and they've just beat Real Madrid. Who cares? Yeah,
yeah, of course. But yeah, very professional performances, particularly at Goodison Park.
Yeah, Sarah, did City's performance results, and I mean even the quality of the goals that they scored, because Gundogan's goal was ridiculously good, and then Haaland's header was fantastic. The free kick again, perfect. Did that result and that performance, is that basically what won the game for Brighton at the Emirates?
I certainly think any glimmer of hope for Arsenal went with that, and thus I think you could see the deflation in Arsenal after that. And the idea that Man City were going to throw this away, Man City haven't thrown this away before, you know, to why anybody thought that they would, I'm not sure. But I was with you, I completely understand how you felt going into that Everton game. Everton having beaten Brighton quite comprehensively a few days before. Now, you're not expecting them to do that to City, but you are thinking they're going to be a hell of a lot more resilient than they were. And again, it's almost like all that logic goes out of your brain about, well, actually, you know, this City side is so much better than this Everton side that if they just remember that, this is what will happen. And it's almost like that is like you're saying about this sort of professionalism, this game by game thing of just going, are we better than this team? Yes. There we go. And we've seen that from other teams at various times. You know, Jack Grealish said after the game last night, he said, we feel unstoppable. And I think that, you know, players say things like that every now and again, and they don't say it lightly because they know it comes back to bite them on the arse. You know, no one ever says they feel unbeatable unless they absolutely feel like there's no way they can lose a game of football because you don't half look stupid next time you lose. But you believed it in him and you believe it from this City side that they actually do think that they can beat anyone at the moment. And they absolutely should think that because they can. And Everton were brushed aside with real ease. I was listening to the radio before that game. I don't often listen to the radio before a game, but I was in a car and they were spending quite a long time discussing what City's lineup would be and would they rest a load of players and would they. And anyone who's been taking notice of City knew exactly what that team would be, knew which players would be rested, knew which, you know, knew that the spine would be there because this was still a game that had to be won. You know, anyone thinking that they were going to like wheel out Calvin Phillips or wheel out, you know, Julian Alvarez without Haaland was an absolute fool because this was clearly a game that had to be won. They won't rest players until, like you said, after this Chelsea game, and then those Brighton and Brentford games do give a little bit of leeway, don't they, on that? But yeah, that the performance against Everton broke Arsenal, I think, on Sunday, that because it was so simple, so easy, and it wasn't, like you said, they made things a little bit too difficult for themselves in that Leeds game. But really, they should have been out of sight at half time in that one. You can understand that little bit of, you know, that little bit of shock when a team kind of comes back into it when you've dominated so massively. But against Everton, you know, you knew Sean Dyche gave up at half time. He took off Dominic Calvert-Lewin even though he wanted to come back on because he thought there's no point. And, you know, if you've got to halfway point and you're already thinking there's no point, you know, you've done your job.
Yeah, you've beaten the will out of them, haven't you? That's the next stage.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statscity.co.uk and browse away. That's statscity.co.uk.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Well, those two results mean that City now need one more win to be champions for the third year running. That's assuming Arsenal don't lose to Nottingham Forest on Sunday. If they don't, then City's first chance for the points is at home to Chelsea. I've been speaking to The Athletic's Chelsea correspondent, Liam Toomey. I started by asking, what's been going wrong at the Bridge this season?
How long do you want this segment to be? Well, it's just been a perfect storm of a disaster, I think, in the first year of Todd Boehly and Clear Lake Capital's ownership. They inherited problems, but I think we're now at the point where the mistakes they've made outweigh the mistakes they've inherited. And when you combine all of those things, you get where Chelsea are in the table and how irrelevant they've been on every front in the hunt for trophies this season. I know they got to the Champions League quarterfinals, but you never got the sense, as you did in 2021, that they could gain momentum and belief and really make a run at the right time. There's just been very little cause for hope this season. And I think that you can divide the two transfer. I know people like to lump the transfer spending into one big round number because that's how headlines and narratives work, and I understand that, but I think you have to divide the two transfer windows into look at them in different terms, I should say. The first window, I think they felt that they were trying to back Thomas Tuchel, which looks even more mysterious in hindsight given how quickly they sacked him after the end of that window. And in the second window in January, they were making all of these big long-term bets on players under the age of 23, which I think a lot of them, we're still waiting to see how those play out. But, you know, what happened in the immediate was that those guys came into a squad that was already dysfunctional, underachieving, struggling to score goals. And you bloat the squad to 31. You make it practically unmanageable for Graham Potter, and the season just a season that was already drifting completely tanked, and then once Potter was sacked and Lampard came in, it's completely flatlined, and you now have a situation where Chelsea are the least motivated team in the Premier League individually and collectively, and I don't think that's necessarily on Lampard. I think it's just a broader state of where Chelsea are.
Yeah, it's been a strange old season in that. I mean, you look at where Chelsea are at the moment, and there's I don't know if it's harsh to say, but there's probably no real hope of a top half finish. But there was never any danger of a relegation fight. Is that basically what's contributed to it? So I just looked, and it's only 5 wins since the turn of the year. Is that what's contributed to that?
Yeah, I think the moment top four slipped away, which was actually, I think, a lot sooner than many people realise. It was probably around the turn of the year that top four started to look unlikely, just because there were so many clubs that they had to jump, and the points gap was already quite big. I think as soon as top four slipped away, the motivation began to slip, and this group of players went into a mode where I actually think, to some degree, the entire club felt like this, where the mindset was it's Champions League or bust. And that meant that they were able to summon something, summon enough to come back and beat Borussia Dortmund over two legs. But even that was not terribly convincing. And as soon as they played a real team, and Real Madrid are very much a real team, as Manchester City know as well, they were completely outclassed. You know, there was a very easy contrast to make, I think, from the way Chelsea ran Real Madrid so close last year. I think they gave Madrid one of the biggest frights that they had for 60, 70 minutes at the Bernabeu, where they were tactically perfect. And there was just no sense that they could, on an individual level or collectively, reach that performance to play to a game plan
that intelligently and with that much discipline. And they in the Premier League, I think they've also been a victim of the fact that I don't think the standard of the league has ever been higher, honestly. I think you look, a few of the other big six clubs have got themselves back into shape. Of course, Manchester United are pretty competent again. I know they're struggling right now. Arsenal have been an incredible story and had an amazing season, even if they're not going to win the league. And Newcastle have risen faster than anyone could have expected. Brighton have been brilliant under Roberto De Zerbi. And now you're at a stage where you've got Unai Emery at Aston Villa and Julen Lopetegui at Wolves. I think that shows to me that the standard of coaching in this league has never been higher either. And so you can't out-talent teams. You need to be well prepared. You need to have continuity and coherence. And Chelsea have had none of those things for most of the season.
What's Lampard's return done for the club, or has it done anything at all? Because it looks from the outside like it's been. I mean, I don't want to pile on the misery, but it feels like it's been a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, the results are what they are, and the losing streak that they went on from the moment Lampard came in. Was a pretty startling rebuke to the logic of appointing him in the first place, where I think Boehly and Eghbali hoped that just by injecting some positive energy into what had become quite a toxic situation with Graham Potter and the fans might have been enough to give them a puncher's chance against Real Madrid at least. And it clearly wasn't. And I think he walked into a squad that was a mess for the reasons I discussed, but also had a significant bank of players who worked with him before and became quite familiar with, you know, his weaknesses as well as his strengths as a coach by the end of his previous stint. So it never worked from day one on a football level. The one way in which Lampard probably has done what the owners hoped he would do is that he has provided a presence on the touchline that fans will absolutely just not turn against. I'll clarify by saying fans in the stadium, because they're online, there has been a very different reaction to Lampard. But in the stadium, no matter how bleak it's become, and it has become very bleak, it's been notable that the fans have resisted any opportunity to show frustration towards him. There have been boos. The team has been booed off, but his name has been chanted. And whenever he's gone over to acknowledge the fans at the end of the game, you know, it's been made very clear to him by them that nothing that happens here in these few weeks could taint his legacy. And that's understandable given what he did as a player at Chelsea and what he means to many of them.
Yeah. It shouldn't all be ridiculously bleak, though, because there's kind of the opportunity. You've got three games of the season left. There's kind of the opportunity to hit the summer and then kind of reboot everything. You know that Pochettino's coming in. So what's the future like then for Chelsea? What's next season going to look like?
Honestly, I think it's a real open book. And I do think, looking at the positive possibilities, I do think there's a real chance of something similar to what we saw with Manchester United from last season to this season, where things looked so bad and so dysfunctional under Ralf Rangnick. But there was a lot of talent in that squad. And you could see that there was a lot of talent that just didn't quite fit together and wasn't being maximised. And then as soon as you get a competent coach in, Erik ten Hag, I know he had a bit of a rough start the first few weeks of the season, and the Ronaldo mess contributed to that. But as soon as he was empowered to make decisions and start to build a positive environment and really have authority within the club, I think United have become a competent team again, and they have something to build upon. And there is absolutely a lot of talent. There's a lot of everything in the Chelsea squad at the moment, but there's a lot of talent. And I do think a lot of the younger players they've signed have real upside. We've already seen a lot of flashes from Enzo Fernandez that, while he was massively massively priced. I won't say overpriced yet because I don't know, but they certainly paid at the top of his value for him. He looks like he could be one of the best midfielders in the world for the next few years and the hub of very competitive Chelsea teams. Mykhailo Mudryk has not shown much yet. I think he's more of a project, but there are flashes of a real, potentially special player in Premier League football with his game-changing speed and skill. I'm not going to go through all the players assigned, but I think there is a lot of talent to work with. I think there's a lot that Mauricio Pochettino coming in will be excited about. I think the talent in this squad is probably the main reason he's taken this job. I think he does see some real materials to work with to play his style of football. And as long as they can get the squad back down to a manageable number and build some real togetherness and a positive energy again with a proper pre-season, I don't see why Chelsea can't be a lot better next year.
Yeah, and if there's one positive thing I can say about Pochettino, as City fans, we're brought up to hate everything that Tottenham Hotspur stand for. There's an old rivalry going back years and years, and he made me enjoy watching Spurs. So it's not all the end of the world.
It's incredible. No one likes Tottenham. I find it amazing that, like, I've always known that Chelsea hate Tottenham, but every other London club despises Tottenham. I didn't know about the Manchester City angle of it. I don't understand what they've done to annoy everyone.
It's very much a one-way street with City, I think. But yeah, yeah, it's one of those things. It's one of those long-held rivalries that for some reason, a certain vintage of City fan they absolutely despise Spurs, and it's the way forward. Liam, obviously this game there's a lot riding on it from a City point of view. Does that make it difficult for Chelsea, do you think, the weekend?
I think it's always been difficult for Chelsea going to the Etihad in recent years. It seems to get progressively more miserable for them each time. And I've been on a lot of those trips. I did the 6-0 under Sarri. I did the 1-0 defeat under Conte, which was actually more bleak than the 6-0 because of the way Chelsea played that game. And of course, they had the misfortune to draw City at pretty much the earliest opportunity in each of the cups this season, and City wasted no time in taking them apart. So I think the Chelsea fans who make the trip will not be expecting anything good. I mean, Chelsea are on, I believe we discussed this on our Straight Out Cobham pod, their fourth best unbeaten run of the season. So maybe they have some form as opposed to no form at all. But I think the only hope Chelsea really have going into this game is that one way or another, Manchester City have some sort of emotional come down from the Real Madrid match. And maybe there's slightly less focus there that will enable Chelsea to be a bit more competitive. But honestly, I don't expect a competitive game based on where these two clubs are.
Well, it's worst possible news for you now, Liam, is I need a score prediction for the charity bet. So over to you. What are you going to go for?
it could be anything because, you know, I have had the impression from previous visits to the Etihad that City as a club enjoy running up the score on Chelsea when the opportunity presents itself. So I'm going to say 3-0 City, and that might actually be conservative.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was Liam Toomey from The Athletic. Sarah, is there a world where City are champions before kickoff on Sunday?
I absolutely think there's a very good chance of that. I think, like I say, I think Arsenal were broken by what happened on Sunday. Forest looked much better. They found how to score goals, which they hadn't done for a while. The City ground is when it can be bouncing, and on Saturday night it is going to be bouncing because what's forgotten in this is that Forest can claim their Premier League place with a win on Saturday, pretty much, barring an unlikely chain of events. So that the motivation for them is greater than Arsenal's on Saturday night. So I think there's a very good chance it's done then. You know, as Man City fans, what do you want? I don't know. Do you want the chance to win it at home in front of your own fans, or you just want it done and then have a party on Sunday? I don't know. You'd have to tell me that.
What do you think, Sam? I'm more than happy to win it on Saturday night and then have Scott Carson in goal on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm not really bothered, to be honest with you. I think as long as we get the job done, then I'll be happy. But I take your point. I think it could be a good opportunity if the league is wrapped up on Saturday night to give some players a rest after a mammoth shift on Wednesday evening. So
even if they need to win against Chelsea, I don't think De Bruyne will be in the starting lineup. I think he'll still be on oxygen.
That's very true. Yeah. To be fair as well, like the situation that we're in with the Premier League now, I think that opportunity is going to come regardless, to be honest with you. So it's a really interesting one. I think Sarah makes a great point. Just the thing that really stuck with me after that Brighton spanking at the Emirates was just how deflated, distraught, shell-shocked Arsenal were, really. And I think that was the point of realisation for them, that not only has the league really slipped from their grasp now, but that they've only really got to blame themselves because of the positions that they were in. 8 points clear with 9 games to go. Granted, they were being chased by, and they are being chased by a very strong Manchester City side, but I was having this conversation with a few friends that are Arsenal fans, and they agreed really that, you know, that a lot's been made about them dropping points at Anfield, which I think in the end is a good point. You know, a point at Anfield. City didn't win there this season.
Bite your hand off for a point at Anfield every year.
Yeah. The results against West Ham and Southampton were criminal going into a game against Manchester City. And at that point, it was the sort of writing was on the wall then. And obviously, you know, Brighton was like the last round in the gun for them, wasn't it, I think?
I think the one thing I will say, Sam, is I think it's important that even if Arsenal win on Saturday night, I think it's important for City to get the job done on Sunday more than anything, because if they don't, they'll end up having to lift the trophy away at Brentford, and it's the one thing you want it to happen in your home stadium, don't you?
Yeah, definitely, and that'll be the motivation for the players. That's exactly, I think it's a great scenario to be in. And I think, you know, we've heard a lot from Guardiola recently about how he, you know, they need their people. And of course, I'm sure that's a great motivation that they have the opportunity to celebrate with their people on Sunday. Although they could be celebrating anyway, because, you know, Forest, like Sarah said, are in good form at the minute. They're unbeaten in their last four Premier League games. So it's not going to be an easy game. Obviously, Forest can secure their safety and, you know, the prospect of rubbing Arsenal's nose in it and really...
There's a lot to be said about that in football, isn't there? Teams, that's a real big motivating factor, yeah.
Definitely. Like, the classic is when a team's already relegated, but they're playing another team in the relegation zone, and they have the opportunity to relegate them as well and bring them down with them. I've been in that scenario, unfortunately, in a previous role, and it's not it's not enjoyable when you get relegated on the last day of the season by a team that's already relegated.
Misery loves company, doesn't it? So.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, look, it'd be great if they lift the trophy on Sunday. And I, without sounding too forward or too big headed, like, I think the majority of us are expecting that to be the case.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the reason why City have the chance to win the title this weekend is that Brighton won at the Emirates last Sunday. City then play Brighton the following Wednesday evening at the Amex. To find out more about their season so far, I've been speaking to Ryan Adsett from the Seagulls Social podcast. We started by discussing whether this was Brighton's greatest ever season.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it is already, before we even play you, to be fair. I was at Arsenal the other day. I think that's probably safe to say. Probably one of the best away days I've ever done. So
it went down well here, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I bet it did. It's been one of those years where it's just everything's sort of worked out. You know, the way everything went down, obviously, as you know, with Graham Potter and with Chelsea taking everything. And then we lost Cucurella and everything like that. Leandro Trossard obviously went to Arsenal. So we've lost a lot this year. And the way it's all sort of just worked out is almost like poetry, really, isn't it? And yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely a case for the best of all time.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, we're recording this ahead of there's actually three games that we're kind of talking about here, because we record this ahead of City against Chelsea for our show. But before you meet City, you travel to Newcastle and you've got Southampton at home. What are you hoping for this season at the moment? I mean, in terms of a league position right now, you are really within touching distance of a European spot. So you must be feeling, I mean, at this stage now, quietly confident?
Yeah, I don't think quietly anymore. I think maybe after the 5-1 against Everton, it was quietly. I think, you know, the way we are now, I think we only need another win, maybe two wins. I think it's down to Villa, how they get on. I think they're playing Liverpool this weekend, if I'm right in saying. So I think if Liverpool win that one, then it's pretty much, yeah, it's going to happen, I think. So yes, I'd like to say that I can have the arrogance now of saying, yes, we should be in Europe next year. But of course, it can all change. But I'd imagine, based on that 3-0 against Arsenal, and you know what we're like historically against bigger sides. We seem to just turn up, you know, against sides below us this season. It's been a big, big, big downfall. And, you know, we could even be contesting for the Champions League if we were, you know, getting these points against the likes of Forest, who beat us 3-1, and Everton. But more so the game against Palace, which sticks out, where we had a goal wrongfully disallowed and we had to get an apology. We had the Tottenham game as well. We got another couple of apologies, and I think we've had the most apologies from the PGMOL this season. So there's definitely a case to say we could even be higher.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at it as well, I didn't realise that you had, I mean, you've got two games in hand on Liverpool, two games in hand on both Spurs and Villa, who are chasing you. So you're right in the mix there. In terms of the football you've been playing this season as well, it's been incredibly entertaining to watch for somebody who's not a Brighton fan. So what's it been like as a Brighton fan?
Yeah, no, it's been, I mean, we've been used to really good football, obviously. With Graham Potter, it was very good football. But I think that De Zerbi's just changed it that little bit more. He's got a style that's very unique, as, you know, very merited by Pep Guardiola and many others. But, you know, and I know that Pep loves a good little big up, doesn't he? But yeah, he's played this sort of, you know, from the back and really, really risky play, passing through the lines, as everybody knows. And the double pivot with Caicedo and McAllister has become so, you know, well documented now across the whole of the Premier League. But the football itself, just to watch, is purely on the eye test, and taking it away from the sort of, you know, stats based stuff. It's pretty incredible to watch. I mean, you know, one minute everyone's sort of saying, get rid of it, get rid of it. And they're on the edge of their seats thinking we're going to concede. And approximately 25 seconds later, everyone's clapping, saying that is fantastic. And it seems to be a massive theme of this season. And it's full credit to De Zerbi how he's taken on this challenge, because, as we say, we've lost so much. And to make it better and better in front of goal, the mentality's better. You know, we're not going to places, you know, not so much thinking we're going to lose, but more so thinking, you know, if we go 1-0 down, we have to then score two, rather than thinking, yeah, but we will outscore you. And I think it's a different mentality of becoming that bigger club, I suppose.
The Blue Moon Podcast. If City won't let you down on the pitch, let us let you down off it instead.
Just in terms of De Zerbi as well, what were the expectations when he arrived? Because I remember when When we played at the Etihad earlier in the season, he was still fairly new to the job. I don't think it was his first game, but it was one of his first games. And you really pushed City a long way that day. In fact, like you were probably the better team, and somehow City came away with a 3-1 win. So what was the expectation of De Zerbi, and kind of has he already kind of outmatched that?
Yeah, well, he's definitely he's done wonders, right? And I think at the time then, I mean, I was at that City game. And I remember thinking, yeah, we deserved a lot more. And I think that's pretty much what we can say for the whole of the season, really. In every game we've been, you know, apart from the obvious in Everton and Forest recently, I think that we've been within touching distance of a win, even against the big boys. Yes, it's a result at the end of the day, and you can't be sort of going off, you should be winning this game because you don't get points for those. But I think it's when you're a club of our stature and you're a man of De Zerbi sort of reputation beforehand, well, it probably wasn't as known around England, and everyone was a bit, you know, shaky, thinking, okay, well, you know, he's got an uphill task at the beginning in trying to replace someone that was, you know, thought of as a bit of a king around here. And, you know, that's a big task in itself. I think it's a very unusual situation for a manager to go in where everything's great, because it's borderline harder than going in when everything's bad, because, you know, the expectations.
You've got nothing to fix, have you? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You've got nothing to fix, but you've got to make it better, and you can't make it worse. So it almost makes it a very, very, very challenging task. And yeah, he doesn't know the players, doesn't know the language, doesn't know, you know, if you're listening to Graham Souness, he doesn't know our game, apparently. And God, how wrong has he been in hindsight? But yeah, that City game particularly, you're right. I think it was our first few games in, and we're playing this new football quickly. And it didn't take long for players to sort of buy into it. And the way that, you know, I think the first game was against Liverpool at Anfield, and we drew 3-3. And Trossard got a hat-trick there. And I think it was only the third player to ever get a hat-trick at Anfield. And it was an amazing moment for the club to be going to Anfield, scoring 3. Yes, you'd like to be winning a game when you score 3 away from home, but it is Anfield and things happen. But it was an early sign of, okay, we're going to be more clinical now, that's for sure. And that trend has stayed. I hope that it continues next season. I think, you know, obviously we're going to lose some stuff, but I don't think that, you know, we're in a situation where it can get any worse from here, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. In terms of a style of play from De Zerbi as well, I've noticed that Guardiola has borrowed from the De Zerbi playbook in a few games this season. I know Guardiola is a big admirer of him and how he plays. What's it like been kind of, what's the transition been like from great, because Graham Potter football was pretty good anyway. What's the transition been like from one to the other?
I think Potter's play was 3 at the back, overload midfield. We were very good when we had Bissouma, Wepu. It's very unfortunate it happened to Wepu. It's so horrible. And, you know, we had such a good midfield then. And I think we thought it couldn't get any better. And this is before probably Alex McAllister was really, you know, thought of as what he is now. It's before Moises Caicedo was really integrated. I don't think Potter used him too much until the end of last season. And, you know, that's mad in itself, right? So when you look at now De Zerbi, it's a different team, because he's gotten out the fringes of the players like Mitoma, you know, who was thought of by Graham Potter as a left back, by the way. And now he's, you know, probably one of the best wingers in the league. It's insane as to how he's changed the narrative. Solly March didn't score, I think, in about 3 years or 2 years or something crazy, or only had a couple of goals in a couple of years under Graham Potter. And now he's one of our top scorers and top assisters. I know he is injured, but he played left back for Graham Potter. So the change has been purely getting the best out of our attackers, because that was always the trouble, wasn't it? I think it was last time I came on here, we were talking about how he plays such great football, but we don't score. Something along those lines. And, you know, that how that's changed now. We play good football and we score, but we always fail to sort of the teams below us, which is a really odd trend. But it's changed in the sense of, you've got almost like a, how would you describe it? You've gotten better, but you've lost personnel. It's a really weird thing to try and quantify.
Yeah.
But it's full credit to De Zerbi, because, you know, to do that is so sort of undervalued probably by everyone. I mean, it's easy to talk about, but what must go in every single day of the week to get that result from each player and that reaction from each player? You know, it's incredible, really.
Yeah, you touched on a couple of players there. Obviously, the headline from outside of the club for a lot of the season has been Alexis McAllister, especially after the World Cup. Yeah. Who are the players that have really performed well for you in recent weeks? I know you mentioned Solly March as well, and he's unfortunately injured. But who else has been doing wonders for you?
I'm a big fan of Levi Colwill. I really am. I do like him a lot. It's a shame. Hopefully we do get to keep hold of him, but it will be a very expensive one to keep hold of. Pervis Estupiñán is a fantastic player. In my opinion, at the moment, the best left back in the league. I know that's probably a bold one, but I do think, Alex Moreno at Vela's good and Luke Shaw's good. But to me, I wouldn't swap Purvis for anyone at the moment. I think he's played so well. He did so well at Arsenal. Inverts really nicely as well. So he practically plays as a midfielder at the best of times. And then even makes runs in from the middle of the pitch, making runs in behind players. I mean, what left back does that? So he's been fantastic. Mitoma, obviously, I think he sort of goes, without saying. Moises Caicedo is a superb player, but most importantly is in my opinion anyway, the sort of rock of the team at the moment is Lewis Duncan and Jason Steele. They've been fantastic with the ball playing, the keeping the team sort of ready for every moment that happens, all the sequence, it sort of goes through them first. And I think that's probably been the most significant part of the progress recently. To drop Sanchez at the time that he did was, everyone was thinking, what are you doing? That's crazy. And then he came out and said that Steele's better than Sanchez, and everyone thought, oh my God, this is Sanchez that has been starting for 3 years. Jason Steele was, down and out at Sunderland. And now Steele is probably one of our best sort of ball players, and he's a goalkeeper. I mean, it's just mad. So yes, it's a squad thing, but that core at the back that's keeping these sequences starting is significant.
Yeah. I'm assuming, given your push for a European place and given the situation that City are in, you'll be more than happy to see a City win at weekend, because it'd make it a dead rubber for this one for City, from a City point of view anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like for you guys to do us a favour a little bit, actually, on Wednesday. I think the last time that you did win the league and came here, we beat you. And that was in the COVID season, if I'm right to say. That'd be nice. It's funny how we've sort of ended Arsenal's title hopes, to be honest, on a pure fan perspective. It's quite funny as to how they were giving it the large at the beginning of the game, and then by the end of it, the ground's empty. But I'd like to hope you do win the league now and then take the pressure off Wednesday, and we can hopefully get some maximum points on the board. That'd be great.
Yeah, well, if it's any kind of guide, if City do manage to get over the line on Sunday, or even before, if Arsenal drop points ahead of them, the last time City played a game directly after having won the title, Scott Carson played in goal, and it was a bit of a mad team selection. So it could be a mad one if that's happened. Which makes this next bit really difficult, right? Because I'm going to need a score prediction from you for the charity bet. So over to you.
Okay. Oh my God, we haven't even played Newcastle yet at the time of recording this, so it makes it very difficult, because I've actually thought about it. I think if we get through Newcastle and you win the league, in an imaginary scenario, then I think that we could do it, because I think that we'll just catch you sleeping. But I think if you don't win the league on Sunday, you'll storm us. So I'm going to say, I'm going to call it a draw to begin with. And I know that's really on the fence, because I want to say we could win, but it depends on too many variables to say that. So I say a 2-2, because I think there's goals in the game. Because I think it will be more open than we think, because I think that De Zerbi against Pep is some battle. So we'll see.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was Ryan Adsett from the Seagulls Social. Sarah, there is a little chance that City might need to get something from this if things don't go their way over the weekend. It's not going to be a nice one to have to go to if you do need to get something, though, is it?
Absolutely not. I think, if somebody had have said, 18 months ago, whatever, that you would have to play Chelsea and Brighton, you wouldn't be looking at the Brighton game and going, that's the one you don't want to have to win, would you? But such is the mess of Chelsea this season, and the phenomenal form of Brighton, and just their Brighton's ability to score goals. I mean, they're you know, astonishing going forward. Lovely to watch. But no, you don't. I think every Man City fan and every Man City player will want that done on Sunday. A, there's the thing about doing it in front of your own fans. Of course, you want to do. But B, there's niggles, isn't there? As soon as you sort of you lose one, there's a little niggling doubt about what's coming next. And C, that's Brighton. And you know, you could if you lose to Chelsea. I don't think you'll lose to Chelsea. But if you lost to Chelsea, then I would expect you to go and lose to Brighton as well. And take it down to a ludicrously and unnecessarily last day at Brentford.
Don't bring the tone down. Come on, no.
But don't worry, because you'll batter Chelsea, so it's all good. That Chelsea side, managed by that manager, you've got, you know, I think this would go down as the most embarrassing defeat of City's season if they lost at home to this Chelsea and that manager.
Yeah.
On Sunday.
Sam, let's look at the positive side. Let's say City beat Chelsea or Arsenal drop points against Forest and the job's done. What sort of game do you expect at Brighton, given that the last time City played a game immediately after having won the title, it was that ridiculous Newcastle 4-3 where Scott Carson played in goal and Ferran Torres got a hat trick. It's like one of those games. Like that could actually be really fun, couldn't it?
Yeah, I'm expecting a party on the South Coast, to be honest with you. I think regardless, you know, if whatever happens on Sunday doesn't go City's way, I think it would still be a really good game between two sides that have played the best, you know, some of the best football in the league this season. I've really enjoyed watching Brighton because they know their strengths and they play to them. They know their system really well. De Zerbi's come in and has picked up the baton from Graham Potter, and he's come in and he's taken on the role really well, and he's taking them further. Obviously, this is a big game for them as well. Like, let's not just think it's all going to be sort of celebrations and what have you. You know, Brighton are looking to cement that top six spot. I know they've got Spurs behind them, but they've also got Villa behind them, who are still in with a really good chance. They're playing some really good football. And obviously, you know, for the Brighton fans, they're going to want to have their best ever season in the Premier League, aren't they? So I'm not expecting an easy game by any stretch of the means, to be honest with you. And I think it's probably going to be one of City's biggest tests. And that excites me, though, as well. You know, the tactical battle that we're going to see. And I'm really looking forward to the Brighton game, to be honest with you. I mean, I'd be looking forward to it a lot more if the league's wrapped up Sunday and the pressure's not on to get a result. I think it will be a much, much more free-flowing game that way.
Yeah, you only like them though because they're City light. That's all. It's just City on a budget. That's all they are.
Well, I don't know. I hope that there's a few players in there that may come to City on a budget as well. That would be quite nice, wouldn't it?
I think you might have to pay quite a bit for a few of those players. Yeah, they've had such a good season.
There's definitely a premium. Interestingly, I don't know why on earth Arsenal are going for Declan Rice when they can get Moise Caicedo for probably a lot less money. And I think he's been a much better player this season. That's one that's not necessarily City related, but just something of interest that I thought I'd throw into the ring.
Well, the answer there is they're apparently going to go for both. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah, right. It's money where your mouth time. We didn't score a win on last week's charity bet, which means that we stay on £1,015 that we've raised so far for the season. William Hill is giving each of the panel a £10 correct score single. The winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They'll be outside the Etihad collecting for the Trussell Trust and for Manchester Central Food Bank for the final time this season on Sunday. So please go and make their last collection a big one before the summer. Head over with donations. They'll be under the bridge by Asda until about 3:30 ahead of kickoff. We've already heard from Liam. He's gone for a 3-0 City win, and he even admits that is a little bit conservative. That's 7-1 and £70 if you're right. Sam, what are you having for Chelsea?
Well, I'm going to go 3-1. I think despite despite Chelsea's how poor they've been recently, they have been unbeaten in their last two, which could mean they come into this with a bit more confidence. And
it's
I think
their, it's their fourth longest unbeaten run of the season. That
there we go. I think as well, given the nature of the game, I do think there's a possibility that City could concede. Yeah. So and 3-1. Also, put us in a good position for the charity bet. 3-1.
Yeah, 10-1 and £100. If you're right, Sarah, where are you thinking for this one?
Pretty close to that. I think 4-1. I think, like you said, Chelsea, but now you've said Chelsea are on this phenomenal unbeaten run. I'm feeling like I need to change it because. No, but 4-1, I'm going to stick with that.
4-1 is 16-1 and £160 if you are right. We heard from Ryan, he's gone for a 2-2 draw on the South Coast. That's 12-1 and £120. Sam, what have you got for Brighton away?
Well, I did like 2-2. I think it's going to be a really good game. I have opted for a City win, though, 2-1.
Yeah, that's largely because I did the interview before I asked you and Ryan had already said 2-2, so you couldn't have it. 8-1 if you're right, £80 there. Sarah, you have you sent this one without having to change. So, I mean, you're expecting a great game by the looks of things.
I'm full of belief. I'm assuming that my Chelsea one is right. And thus, City will have nothing to play for, largely half cut, and it'll be 3-3.
3-3 will bring in £450 because it's 45-1. So I really hope. I hope that both of your predictions are right this week because it'll go to add in well over half the kitty again in there. So it'll be good bit of fundraising. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. I'm going to squeeze in a few questions to finish. Get in touch on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email through the website as well, bluemoonpodcast.com. Johnny the Bakewell Blue has been in touch on the emails to say, can we have a whip round to make sure that Ilkay doesn't go to Spain, please? Irreplaceable, enough said. Sam, can you understand why the Gundogan situation has got as late as it has in these contract negotiations and they're not moving heaven and earth to keep him?
He's certainly playing for a 2-year deal, isn't he, at the minute? I don't know. I think it's just, it's probably something that the club and Gundogan have said, look, let's pick this up at the end of the year. Like, no stress. From an outsider looking in, that may seem ridiculous and like, let's lock him in now sort of thing. But, that just may be the conversations that the club have been having. By all accounts and all, the reports, there's a 1-year deal on the table. But there's also a 2-year deal potentially at Barcelona for him, which I think is probably more appealing for him. But I don't see why not. Like, the form he's in at the minute, the role that he has at Manchester City, not just as captain, but in terms of on the pitch as well, he's a really key player at the moment. And I think he still could be key for 2 years, definitely.
Yeah. Sarah, do you get the impression that if he was going to sign an extension, he might have done it by now?
I think there is that, but I think when you get to 32, it is all about the length of the deal. And I think what City probably need to do is give him a straight choice between Barcelona and City, because if you're asking him to choose between a 2-year contract at Barcelona and a 1-year contract at City, there's no doubt where he's going to go. So I think it's the onus is on City to match that, isn't it? Make him a straight choice. And everything we know about City and Pep Guardiola is if he still wants to go to Barcelona, then, hands up, he can go, because if that's where he wants to be, that's fine. But I think at least make it a straight choice.
Yeah. Final question for this week comes from Pete on Twitter, who says, with the potential for the FA Cup final to go to penalties and with City's recent penalty struggles, Haaland aside, I'm interested to know who you would pick for your 5 penalties if you were Guardiola managing a hypothetical shootout. Let's all assume here right now that Erling Haaland is going down, probably as number one in the list. Who would your other 4 be? Sam, any ideas?
Well, I now feel sick again, so thanks for that. Oh, God, the prospect of penalties against Manchester United in the FA Cup final at Wembley is horrendous.
It could be against Inter in the European Cup final.
The Man United scenario is that David De Gea never looks like he's ever going to save a penalty. So as long as you keep it on target, you've basically nailed it.
Yeah, that's the trouble, though, as well. That's the other thing to add even more fuel on this fire of pessimism. Like, it will be the one time that David De Gea does save a penalty in his life, and it will be in the FA Cup final penalty shootout against City. Like, the writing's on the wall already there. Let's just not play it. We know what's going to happen.
There's no thinking like a football fan, is there? Goodness me.
on to the question. Erling Haaland, Kevin De Bruyne, Ilkay Gundogan. Bernardo Silva. Edison.
Interesting that you didn't put Mahrez in there.
Mahrez for potentially Bernardo or Edison. Yeah. We just all want Edison to take a penalty, don't we, to be honest?
I'm mostly interested in how De Bruyne looks after 120 minutes of football. you think he's still going to be on the pitch to take a penalty then?
Yeah, it's a good job those shirts aren't cotton anymore, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Sarah, what about you? I mean, I Sam's taking the wind out of my sails. I was going to suggest Edison as one of the takers, largely because I'd love to see it. But is there any that he didn't mention that you might be considering? Phil Foden, maybe?
I don't know. That's exactly the name that came to mind. Phil Foden takes a decent penalty, doesn't he? For some reason, I wouldn't trust Grealish. I think he'd just have a little silly moment and do something daft. But, John Stones, I think, as well. Just, you know, just a sense, somebody sensible you want. Any of them. It doesn't matter. It's not going to happen. Scott Carson,
yes, I'd like to say that. You know, you say sensible head, though. Rodri is the most sensible head in that team, and I've seen him take one penalty. He scored, but it was the worst penalty I've ever seen. So I don't know if sensible always goes hand in hand with good penalty conversion. Who knows? Right, well, that's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you also to my guests for this one, to Sam Roscoe.
Always a pleasure.
And Sarah Winterburn.
My pleasure, mate.
Don't forget, there's a bonus show every Monday for Patreon backers. There's a short clip of this week's Coming Up Shortly season.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Throughout this season, and you'll have spotted the theme, I'm always backing on our free-flowing and us having the answer up front to get us out of the situation. And again, this was one of those games where nothing's coming. They were a stubborn defence. I don't remember feeling too much pressure at the other end in our defence, but I remember thinking, this isn't coming. And then the relief. It wasn't as much euphoria in terms of carnival party atmosphere. It was like a joined up outpouring of relief, really, wasn't it? You've got Aston Villa defenders strewn everywhere, pouring down. I can see it clear as day. And then Dzeko pops up and gets a very important goal. And then it was floodgates then after that. I had the freedom of the pitch to go and score another wonder goal like he did so many times that season.
Do you know he took fewer touches in the goal that he scored in the 93rd minute? That ridiculous run where he picked up in his own half and ran the length of the pitch and belted it in. Yeah. He took fewer touches in that run than he did when he set up Stevan Jovetic a few minutes earlier. He took about 14 touches inside the Villa box to set up Jovetic.
To set that one,
and then he took about 10 his own half. He took about 10 to take the length of the pitch.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.